Dr. Jonathan P. Higgins is a writer, speaker, and media strategist whose focus is on elevating the voices of marginalized people in the media. Named Business Equalities and the National Black Justice Coalition's top LGBTQ people to watch, they continue to champion the stories that so many of their ancestors did not get to tell. Ladies, gentlemen, thems, theys, nims, let's talk to Dr. John. I'm so excited for this. I always like to ask my guests as the first question, who are you? Because I think there's a difference between reading your bio that's all put together, but who are you? Because that could change. Mm-hmm. So who are you?
That's a really good question. I think it's depending on the day, who am I? These days, I am a person who is doing a lot of things for a lot of people, including myself. I'm trying to get myself together as well, meaning trying to be in therapy and make sure that I'm following in line. It's weird because these last few days that I've been on my bike, you know, everyone knows me. I'm a huge Pelotoner and I'll be on my bike. And one of the folks that was leading the class had basically asked a question. They said, you know, just know that by being on the bike, you're showing up for yourself. And they said, how are you planning to show up for yourself for the rest of 2024? And it was like, I was like, wow, like I hadn't even thought about it. Like I think about it often, but I never really sat with the notion of how am I showing up for myself? And so I think that that's, you know, when you ask the question, who are you? I'm someone currently in the process of trying to figure out how do I separate all of the stuff that I'm doing for everyone else and all of the things and all of the accolades and all of that from who I am. Like, who am I outside of all of those things I'm quote unquote trying to always accomplish? And so, I think that that's really who I am right now. I'm a person who is working through and trying to figure out how they're showing up for themselves and how they're trying to separate themselves from all of the expectednessness of this industry, if that makes sense. Oof,
yeah, comma, yes, exclamation, yes, all of the above.
Yeah.
How did we meet? I want to hear your version of it.
How did we meet? Well, my version of it. That's funny. You know, I'll just say, I think we met in college. I think you had a very, you know, so I had friends or I should even say friends. I had
we don't use that word. There we go.
Yeah, we had acquaintances, but we ain't really friends anymore, Joe. But at the time, you know, I may have had acquaintances, friends who I think you were either connected to like very, very closely. You ran in different circles of people that either I knew as an RA, we went to the same college. I was a resident assistant. And we were always at different programs. We were always involved with different and, you know, different, but the same things. I think we were both Black and, you know, at the time I didn't know you were queer, but I'm saying like, I think being Black and queer, trying to figure out who we were in a space that was predominantly white. I think that that's really how we just, you know, our paths collided. But I think, you know, even I'll say this, I don't think at that time, like we knew each other, but I don't think we knew each other.
Yes.
And I think it took kind of some time and some years because, again, like we were in school together between, I would say maybe 2005, 2008.
Don't tell our age. They don't know
that. It is what it is. If you Google it, you can find it, child. But I think, you know, we didn't really link back up and start really. Yeah, like 7 years later, like 2010, 2011, 2012, we started following each other on social media. But it wasn't until like 2017 that we really started talking to each other and saying, hey, we're both, you know, we're both trying to build brands. We're both trying to make it, quote unquote, in this world. And we're trying to change different systems and our paths really connected in that way. So I think as adults, us meeting in college was different than us meeting as adults.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I have found like my closest people that I met during that time, we knew of each other, but now we know each other.
Correct.
Yeah, very that.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, bless that place for whatever that little gifts they gave.
and debt.
Honey, they can come get it. Get it now.
Yeah.
What does trauma mean to you?
Yeah, trauma is a very interesting word because I think by textbook, it's something that is supposed to shake you up, right? It's something that leaves you unsettled. I think the textbook definition, we see someone who's basically broken or harmed or hurt or sad. But I will find that even trauma shows up for me in different ways that not even just makes me sad, but I or even angry, but I think about the ways that I just don't feel like my best self, right? I oftentimes don't like large groups. I mean, and again, this is stuff I'm all trying to work through. I don't like being in large groups of queer people at times, right? Because of trauma that I've had when, you know, I was in college. I struggle around, I struggle in spaces of academia because I don't feel safe there, right? Because of the targeting that has happened to me throughout my career. There's so many things that can trigger me. And when I say triggered, it's always something like, even certain cities, it's weird because I've been trying to, you know, get over the trauma that all of the stuff that happened to me when I worked in Long Beach, and the idea that I do not like going to that city for anything. Like, people, oh, I love Long Beach, and I'm like, immediately when I hear the name Long Beach, it there's like this curdle that happens in my stomach of, I can't stand anyone there. I can't stand anything about the city. If I have my choice not to interact with anything or anyone in that city, that's what, like, it's my number one idea. Like, I never want to go there. And so all of that to be said, like, I think trauma is really just a way of a feeling. It is you knowing things have happened to you, uh-huh. and knowing that you are the only thing is triggered. You're triggered by certain things and certain moments and certain emotions that have happened to you, and how they leave you unsettled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Today we are talking about like a specific type of trauma,
right?
That I don't think we talk about as Black people, which this is also, baby, we in Black History Month. So we mm-hmm. have Black ass conversations, which are real. And so one of the things that we as Black people often hide behind, negate, ignore, utilize is religion. Mm-hmm. And you grew up in a very interesting time, in a very yeah. interesting religious background. I would love to hear about it. There's just so many questions I have, but feel free to jump in the ways that this has affected you, how you grew yeah. up in it, how you got there. Wherever you want to start, I will meet you there.
Yeah. Okay. I think so. When you talk about religion, I think I wouldn't say it's hard. I think religion is something that everyone, whether they know it or not, even, you know, so it's interesting because I have friends who are like, well, I'm not religious. And it's like, well, yeah, you may not be religious, but I'm sure religion shapes the ways that you see the world, the way you feel about things, even though you don't think that you do, right? Like, what's morally mm-hmm. right, what's morally wrong? A lot of that is aligned in religion. And so I guess the only place I can really start is the idea of growing up in a religion that I didn't get a choice of, right? Like, how do you, and it's something I think a lot about, how unfair it is to
children
that they don't get the autonomy. It's for me, I always go back to the idea of how, you know, there are folks who are like, oh, I'm not religious, but I'm like, yeah, girl, yes, you are. Because even if you don't believe you're religious, religion has impacted you in some way, shape, or form. The other part of that, and I'm kind of glad that we paused because I would have missed this thought. I think that before we get into kind of what my history is with religion, I mm-hmm. truly have learned that there's a difference between religion and spirituality. Yes. And I think that there's not enough conversation around that, right? There are a lot of religions that pose this notion of you're supposed to have a relationship with God, but you also need to listen to everyone else and do all of these things. And I'm like, that's different than spirituality. So I think we're going to talk more about that towards the end. But I go back to this point of I've always had a very interesting relationship with both religion and spirituality because of the religion that I grew up in. So
right.
From the time I can remember, like the earliest time I can remember, and that's probably, I would say maybe around 4 or 5. 5. I was raised a Jehovah's Witness. My grandparents were witnesses. My mom was a witness. My father supposedly was a witness. cousins, uncles, aunties on both sides were witnesses. Both sides. I don't ever really remember ever anybody in my family being like, it was either I was a witness at some times and I left the religion, or I am a witness now and I'm partly in, partly out, or it was I'm a devout Jehovah's Witness. There was never anyone being like, oh, I'm Catholic, or oh, I'm, you know, Jewish. Like, it literally was like, when you say deep, it was generations deep of people being Jehovah's Witnesses. And it was interesting, child. And I say interesting, not in a good way. So
yeah, that's so I don't think I've ever met someone that was generations.
I am
generations depth.
Yeah, very much.
Did you know that you were different from other
always
people?
Yeah, always. Okay. Ever since I was a kid. I mean, even down to the, and that's the thing that makes, that made religion hard for me, right? So you have like my brother and my cousins, and this is me just making assumptions, right? About people's gender performance and people's gender identity and the way that they identify. I always kind of knew, maybe since I was like 5, that I was like, oh, I was handed a different card than everyone else, right? It was kind of like, oh, why everybody else got Uno cards? They handed me a good like Candyland card. I was like, oh, okay. I was like, all right, so all y'all niggas playing Uno, can I say the word? Like, can y'all
say whatever you want?
Okay, all right. I just want to make sure. I'm like, oh, so all y'all niggas playing Uno and I'm over here playing Candyland. Okay, got it. So that was very much what life was giving for me as a child, right? It was like, yeah, as soon as I could understand, and it wasn't even like a, like, what is the word gay? I didn't know what the word was, but I just knew I was different. And so then you start getting into kind of the religious aspects of it. We can spend hours talking about the religion in itself around the notion of what you can and can't do, who you can and can't talk to, who you can and can't hang out with, what type of relationships I have with people in and out of the religion. But it was also the relationship I had with myself. Like, I learned very early on that my family did not like who I was, or again, I have to give people kind of like, you know, I'm a context before content. So a big part of the context around me, growing up, my voice was always lighter, and it still is. Like, people always get on the phone and they say I sound like my mom. Which when you read that now as an adult, it's, oh, this man sounds like a woman, right? So I've always had a lighter voice. I always spoke very openly and candidly with my hands. I was always very, what's the word I'm looking for, animated. I have an interesting relationship with the word animated, because when you say animated, oftentimes that is a, it can be read as a, what do you call that?
Like a feminine?
Almost that, yeah, but it could be a microaggression, right? So okay, I struggle with that word of animated at times, and what people mean by it or why they use it. But there were just all of these things, you know, and it's like you're putting all of that onto a 5-year-old. Like, how fucked up is it that
baby just trying to walk?
Right, I'm just trying
to figure it out.
I'm trying to just, you know, it literally felt like people put the world on me at a very young age. And so there were all of these expectations. There were all of these things. And trigger warning, you know, suicide came up very early for me, because by the time I was like 8 or 9, from all of the things that people had said to me, the teasing that my cousins did of me, my family said things to me, my uncle didn't like me talking around him, you know, being whooped for quote unquote not doing something that a boy should do, being forced to do certain things in relation to the religion, right? You know, being told at a very young age that being gay is wrong, and that I would die for it, right? I'm nine. Like, yeah. You're, you know, by the time you're at nine, you're like, well, then why did God make me? If God is so mad at me for being who I am, then why was I created? That became my rationale by the time I was like maybe 12. And so that drove me into
a deep question.
It is, isn't it? You know, yeah. And you're sitting here at a very young age trying to figure out, you know, if everyone in this world is so against me and so mean to me. And I think that's what I've been able to process it with my therapist as, you know, people were just both in and out of the religion, very, very mean to me. And now as an adult, you know, I can sit with it and I can understand why, right? Because a lot of religion is mean. A lot of it is built on fear. A lot of it is
bullying.
Yeah, it's bullying. It's fear mongering.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's kind of what my earliness started with religion.
Mm-hmm. Who protected you?
You know, I'm a true believer that two things can be true at one time. I will say that as much as my mom also had, I had issues with her growing up around specifically the religion and expectations. And, you know, my mom never made it a thing, right? It was always kind of one of those things of like, this is who Jonathan is. And, you know, y'all better leave my baby alone. Like, that was the thing that my mom would always say. And so outside of the stuff I had to work through with my mom, there were a lot of issues that I had with her too. I will say, I think the reason why I'm still so close to her and I'm still so loving towards her is because she was a huge protector of me in so many different aspects. I mean, there are two or three major memories that I have where I know my mom like went up for me and I was like, okay, I love her. Like, I remember being in seventh grade and one of my teachers, like, I kid you not, I'm gonna call him out, Mr. Seeger.
write him down. Google Mr. Seeger. Is that
Mr.
you?
Hello? Seeger, seventh grade, Arrowview Middle School. He called me a fag in front of the entire class. He told me to stop acting like a fag in front of all the students. And they all laughed at me. And so I went home.
That's what people do.
Right. Especially at seventh grade. I went home and I told my mom. And my mom, my mom wanted to fight. I remember having to ask my mom. I was like, mom, we have to go. Like, mom, we have to leave. Because my mom walked, I will never forget it, my mom walked into the main office, asked me where my class was, and she like pushed past all of the security. She pushed past all of the other teachers. It was like, ma'am, you can't come in here without a pass. And she was like, fuck a pass. And she went directly to his, and I just remember like sitting in class being like, oh shit, like, my mom is about to turn this classroom out. And people, like the kids who laughed at me, being kind of like thrown that my mom would take the day off work to come up there and to like almost fight this teacher for calling me names. So I remember that. I remember a specific moment with one of my uncles where my mom went off. I remember a neighbor saying something out of pocket and my mom getting into it with the neighbor. So like, yeah, they're very much as much as my mom still had her issues, my mom was, she was a force, and I mean, she still is, but she always made sure that I knew that she had my back, so.
I love that. Yeah. I know what a Black mama looks like running up into a school, because Cheryl has as well.
Yes.
And them people were extra friendly after
thrown,
that.
Thrown, because... Baby, let me tell you, a Black
you
mama come
her,
up,
baby?
She said, who did what now? And I was like, Edwina is hot. So yeah, yeah.
Religion or a cult?
Woo, my child, my God. You know, I'm you know what? I'm a stand-up business and I'm going to say.
Let me sit up
that all really, in my mind, all religion is a cult. And I have to say, like, you know, some people would say, well, I disagree. And I would say, well, if we look at the schematics of how a lot of religion works and moves. And it's funny because it's like, me and Jonathan, so as you know, like, me and Jonathan were really into, like, the Scientology conversations when Scientology was kind of, like, at the forefront because of Leah Remini. And then, you know, we have, you know, Mother God has this documentary that's out, right? And it's really interesting.
I watched Mother God.
And I did too, right? And so, like, I'm always very interested in anything. And my partner's like, well, why are you so interested in it? It's all the same. Right. And I'm like, I think as a person who was raised in a, and I put quotations around for those who are listening, quotations around religion, but I feel like I too was in a cult, right? Like, I left the cult, and we can really get into the schematics of why I call Jehovah's Witnesses a cult based off of the way it felt when I left. But I say all of that to say that there are so many markers of these religions with quotations that feed and move and look like a cult, right? If you, you don't have, if there are people who are shaming you or making you feel bad for saying, you know what, this religious teaching doesn't align with me and my values anymore, I'm going to leave. That is a cult, period. Right. And all religions do it. Catholics do it. Christians do it. You know, Muslims do it. Like, there's all of there are all of these different ways that formalities are created to scare people into staying. And so I think for me, yes, I have a strong, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. I stand on the notion that I believe that a lot of religions are cults. And specifically the reason why I can only really speak to, you know, I wasn't a Scientologist. I wasn't raised with any other religion. The only reason why I can say that I believe that Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult is because right around the time that I opted to leave. So there's a specific, I'm going to tell the story of what happened.
I was going
to
ask anyway.
For me to leave. So I remember, so before you met me, I started at Cal State in 2003. And let's talk about how, when I told people that I was going to college, so a lot of people don't know this, but Jehovah's Witnesses, at least back then, because I don't know how they move now, back then, they were very anti, like, school. Like, if you went to college, whether it be community college, whether it be university, it was a big no-no. And so I remember going to a specific brother. I don't know if he's still alive. So I don't know if you know, in the religion, they have what they call brothers, which are the elders. They are like four or five elders that that kind of quote unquote shepherd the kingdom halls. And I'll just say this. So there were two brothers that kind of knew me and quote unquote was like watching me. One brother was watching me because he knew me and his son were close. And when I say close, what I mean is he knew that me and his son were into each other. And the fact that his son, he didn't like the fact that his son was into me. And so it was kind of like this very, like, we were just very friendly, but we were also very close. And so this brother was like, I'm watching you, basically. And then the other brother was just very much one of those brothers who he felt like all of the teenagers in the Kingdom Hall were too, because we were all friends with each other. And that's the other thing about Jehovah's Witnesses. You're not supposed to be friends with anyone outside of your Kingdom Hall. Like,
Is it because they don't want you to get, like, different perspectives? They don't want you to learn what other people are learning? Is it like a control? It was clearly a controlling aspect of what you consume.
Bingo. So they don't want you seeing. So I think a big part of it is, and this is just me again, I don't know if it's me being jaded or if it's really reality, but it is a sense of, I don't want you to see other people being free, like having freedoms to be able to make decisions and to, like, we want to make sure that you're not
start questioning.
Right. Because their favorite scripture to use in the Bible is 1 Corinthians 15:33. And the point of do not be misled, bad association spoils useful habits. And so those useful habits, right, is what they oftentimes keep their hand on in the notion of, I am teaching you how to quote unquote please Jehovah. And if you don't X, Y, and Z, or if you start to step out of those things, then you are putting yourself at danger, quote unquote, of losing paradise. They love to throw that back at you of this notion of, you're doing everything for Jehovah so you can make it to paradise. And if you don't make it to paradise, that's going to be a problem. You're going to die with all of the people who don't believe, right? So when you're in your formative years of 13 to 17, right? You're terrified and thinking of, and I mean, and it's not even me just saying this. If you talk to other witnesses, there's a stupid yellow book called the My Book of Bible Stories. You want to talk about trauma? That book is scary. And they read it to children. It has actual pictures.
Yellow book.
Okay. It's a yellow book called My Book of Bible Stories. And if you thumb through it, it has actual pictures of people dying in hellfire. Imagine being seven, reading this book and seeing people dying by hellfire.
It gives trauma. Yes, absolutely. That's where the trauma began.
You get where I'm going, right? So, yeah. So I can't even look at that book without shaking. So now I'm 17 and okay. I'm telling these two brothers who are quote unquote watching me that I'm going to college, right? And this is they're automatically going, well, we had other plans for you in the sense of we want you to go to Bethel. And for people who don't know what Bethel is. So Bethel used to be this, what's the word I'm looking for? So basically it's where all of their Bibles, all of the watchtowers, all of the awakes, it's where all of the literature is made. It's published, it's done, right?
So is it a place?
It is a place. It's okay. It's almost like, so if you were to go to like Penguin Random House, if you were to go okay, to yes. like the actual place where Penguin Random House makes all of their books, right? It's like a publishing company. And so the brothers of the Kingdom Halls are supposed, like they form, but you don't just get to go. You have to do all of these things to be a person who can go to Bethel, right? And only men can go to Bethel. Women have to be invited, but men are sent to Bethel, if you follow where I'm going. So it's basically like, in a way, it's like exile. It's a way for them to glorified exile because you are not showing up the ways that they want you to show up. So they're going to send you to go work behind the scenes. So that way you don't have any contact with the world. They don't want you being, they basically don't want you being encouraged to be your authentic self. Right.
That's wild.
Isn't it wild?
How was it for you when they told you that? You were like, I'm about to go out. And they were like, baby, we got Bethel over here. You're like, excuse me?
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing for me was I saw, and that's the thing that partly made me do my dissertation the way that I did it. For me, Bethel didn't feel like I at 17, I knew the way I felt going to these meetings, I was like, man, I don't want to do this shit no more. I'm like, I'm over door to door. I'm over these meetings. I'm over all of this. Like college for me was, okay, I'm about to turn 18 and I'm going to be able to do whatever the hell I want to do. It's an escape, right? And so then you have, and mind you too, like there's this other part of this conversation where I'm poor, okay? Like, living in a two bedroom, one bathroom apartment with my mom, my brother, my stepfather, and I'm at 17 still sharing a room with my brother. So again, no shame. My mom is doing the best that she can, but in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, this school is about to give me $10,000 to go to read some books. Who
like maybe sign me up
in 2003? $10,000, you know. Was it cha-ching? Let the cash register ring. Like, what you know? If Cal State San Bernardino is telling me I'm about to put $10,000 in your bank account so you can have food and you can have access to a car and you can have, hell yeah, I'm going to college, right? So that was for me. Bethel wasn't, the math wasn't mathing for me around Bethel. I was like, you know, I need money. So that's what really sold me on wanting to go to college was this notion of I knew that there was going to be not only one, this element of freedom and choice for me to be able to live my day to day, but also I knew that I was, you know, I was getting financial aid. I was in, you know, what is that program called? It's not SOAR. It's the other one for Black and brown babies who are broke. But anyway, there were grants and stuff that were being thrown my way. So all that to be said, I told the brothers I was going to go and they said, okay, but please don't live on campus. And I said, why? And they said, because you'll be surrounded by people who don't share your same religious thought. We just think it's a bad idea. And I said, okay, bet. What I also think that they didn't want me living on campus for was because I was going to be living in the dorms with the men.
Sin, sinner, you little sinner.
Said Jews go be.
They said, "We know you. We want to be with the men's. We see it in your eye.
We see it, in baby. It wasn't just in my eyes. It was all over, hello." So I said, "Okay." So my first two semesters, not even semesters, two quarters. Let me talk about it. The first two quarters, because Cal State used to be on a quarter system. The first two quarters, I decided that I wasn't going to live on campus, but that I was going to still be doing the thing of a witness, but also going to college. And I met a guy, and this story's not going to go the way you think it's going to go. I met a guy, and because I was working at the time, I was working at Starbucks, and they had already had issues with that too, because at the time, Starbucks was really known for being this very inclusive. They were like, the early 2000s, they were extremely liberal, way more liberal than what they are now, and they still are.
They sure are.
And so when I started working at Starbucks, another red flag for people, right? They were like, we don't really love this idea of you working at Starbucks, but whatever.
You're too secular.
You're starting to get away from what the vision we have for you. So I'm working at Starbucks. I start working at the Starbucks on campus, and you probably, do you remember when the Starbucks used to be in the Commons?
I do.
Okay. So I helped move that Starbucks into the Commons. Okay. So I was a part of that, making that happen. And I meet a guy, and we're still friends to this day. His name is Mike. And Mike was just cool. Like, he was a cool Asian dude. And when I say cool, and I have to put Asian on it, because he was a nigga. He understood Black culture. He
I know what that means, though, and others will also.
He was a cool ass dude. And I would hang out with Mike all the time. Like, me and Mike had two classes together. We had math together. We had English together. And he'd be like, hey, you want to go get some pizza? Yeah, let's go get pizza. You want to go to a movie? Yeah, let's go to a movie. Do you want to go to, you want to go hang out at, what's that the place in Riverside we used to go to? Castle Park. Do you want to go to Castle Park? Yeah, let's go to Castle Park. Like, me and Mike were thick as thieves in our first year of college. And then I met all of the friends that I made at the Starbucks on campus. And so I'm hanging out with him all the time, right? Like, I'm a true Cal State Coyote. Okay. Yeah. And then he starts dating a girl named Christina. And am I going too long with all this, with the storytelling?
Okay. No, we love this.
Okay. So
details, you know me.
Right. So Mike starts dating Christina, who lives in the dorms, right? And we're hanging out in Tokyo all the time. Like, we're literally always in
Tokyo. I lived near Tokyo.
Yeah.
I was a Joshua girl, but okay.
Yeah. So I'm in Tokyo all the time. And it got to the point where, because Christina had her own, she had one of those big rooms, but it was the single bed. And so Mike is spending the night. I'm spending the night. Christina is letting us spend the night. And then eventually one day, like, Christina looks at me. She's like, why don't you live on campus? And Mike was like, Mike didn't want to live on campus. So Mike was like, no, I'm not doing it. But I was like, you're right. I know everybody here, and I'm pretty much here all the time. So why not? So I go home and I tell my family, yo, I think I'm actually going to leave. I'm going to go live on campus because I get enough financial aid for it. And I know everybody over there, so I might as well. And baby, when I tell you, it was as if I said I was about to join a Satanist cult. That the way that not only my grandfather but my my family had a fit. My mom didn't, which I thought was very interesting. My mom was very much kind of like, okay, you're grown, you do whatever you want to do. But my other family, they lost their minds. Same thing with the people in the church. So I said, okay, bet. So, you know, my friend Tiana helps me. We all move. They help me move my stuff in. I drive up to Cal State. You know, I move into my room. I'm living the life, living on campus. And then I don't know if it was an email or if it was a letter. It was one of them. I don't know which one it was, but they basically had said, you're now starting to miss meetings. We have not seen you out in service. the brothers want to meet with you. And I knew what that meant. Like, I knew that like they were trying
to the principal's office.
They were trying to put me on reproof. And so I don't know if any of you know what reproof is. But there's two different things. So there's, you can be either reproofed or you can be disfellowshipped. Reproof is like someone basically saying, how do I explain this to somebody who's not a witness? Reproof is almost like you're being put on punishment. Okay. So, you know, and say, if when you do something out of pocket and your parents say, I know you did it, even though I don't know you did it.
Yeah,
putting you on punishment because
just in case you did something.
Right. That's what reproof is for Jehovah Witnesses. Basically, meaning I can still talk to people, but I'm letting the entire Kingdom Hall know that you're somebody that they need to be watching out for, that you're a bad association. Oh.
Okay, how do you let everybody, is there an email, a smoke signal, a newsletter?
Girl, they get up, honey. So the way that you want to talk about people being disfellowshipped and in trouble, how they did it. And again, I want to make sure that I'm making this very clear. I'm not speaking as if I know what they do today. I'm saying this is what they did when I was a part of the org. They would have something called ministerial meeting, which happened on Tuesday, and everybody in the congregation would come to the Kingdom Hall. And before we would like end the meeting, one of the elders would walk up to the front and say, Jonathan Paul Higgins has been put on reproof. Or they'll say, Jonathan Higgins has been disfellowshipped. And then it was kind of like, all right, have a good day. And then you would walk down. And then after the meeting, people would stand around and, ooh, girl, I wonder what he got. Ooh, girl, I know that. I knew that was
coming. So it's just like an out loud, put you on the stage. Might as well start tomato, tomato, boo, 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 and you in the face.
Yeah. Yep. And the gag is you don't know when they're going to do it. So could be at the meeting sitting in the third row, and one of them brothers will walk up to the front and say, you've been put on reproof, or you've been disfellowshipped.
And so do you have to just get up and leave?
Nah, girl, you just sit there and you just take it. But oftentimes by that time, a lot of the people who have been reproofed or people who have been disfellowshipped, they've stopped coming. So that's the reason why. Like for me, so in my case, right? So I get this letter probably, I would say maybe on a Friday, and they want me to show up to a meeting Monday night so that they could prep themselves for whatever they're going to do on Tuesday. I got the letter and being, again, when you're 18/19 and you're also in this mind of like everybody in my family is a witness and everybody I know is a witness and everything in my life is connected to this religion, obviously you're going to do whatever you can to quote unquote try to save yourself, right? Because you don't want to lose the 18 years of life that you've built in this religion. And mind you, so the religion or the Kingdom Hall that I went to was, they call it, it was called, what was it called? Something Shadows. Shannon Shadows. I don't know what it was called, but anyway, I think Mountain Shadows, that was the name of my, so each congregation has a different name. However, the gag is that they all intertwine with each other. So like, when you live in a certain area, you're a part of like Paris Hill congregation, or you're a part of Mountain Shadows congregation, or you're a part of. And so at that time, because of where I lived, I was a part of the Mountain Shadows congregation, right? And they have different times that they show up to the Kingdom Hall. However, I knew everybody from Paris Hill because I grew up in the Paris Hill congregation. And so it became this thing of like, I went to this meeting because I was like, everybody and their mama are going to know if I don't go to this meeting, they're going to know that either I get put on reproof or I'm going to get disfellowshipped.
So you went.
So I went.
Okay.
So I get to the meeting and my God, it's the four brothers that are there that are over my Kingdom Hall, which is Mountain Shadows. And it did, again, it's not going to go the way that you think it's going to go. And that's the gag of it all. That is the gag of it all. So I get to the hall and there's nobody else there. It's just me and the brothers. And we're in the back room and they pull up. They slide up. So at first it starts off with how are you doing? Right. Cause they want to make it seem like they actually care about you. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm fine. I'm going to college. I'm working at Starbucks. You know, I got a little bit of change in
my life. Living.
You know, I'm doing the best that I can. Right. And then one of the brothers pulls a piece of paper and he flips it over and it's my profile on a gay website called xy.com. And he was like, okay, so what's this?
How did they find it? Baby, who was searching? Because when you seek, you find.
So somebody was doing double time, right? They were doing, that was how the conversation started. And they said, you know, why are you on this website when it's catered to gay people? And I said, well, one, I said, I have been, as you know, I've been trying to explore my, you know, sexuality, and I don't have no other means of doing that, right? Outside of, like, I can't talk to anybody. I don't have any friends who are queer openly in this org. So, you know, I'm, instead of me sitting at home and trying to figure out or being scared about who I am, I'm trying to talk to other people to figure out if what I believe to be true about myself is true. So then they said, okay, so we have another question. Who are you hanging out with? Specifically, we saw someone from the congregation said that they saw you at the movies with people who were not from the Kingdom Hall. And that for me was when I said, okay, I said, somebody is watching me. And this shit is scary. Okay. Yeah. So I even said that to the brother. I said, I am a little alarmed that somebody is watching me right at this point. He's like, well, no, I don't think it's, he's like, I don't think you need to be alarmed. I think that you just need to know that people care about you. And I said, still sketch, right? So they take out this piece of paper and they slide it to me and they say, all right, well, we want to know if you have been active with any other men. And I said, okay, this is getting too personal. I said, I am an adult and I don't need to explain anything to anyone about who I hang out with, who I keep as my friends. None of y'all niggas are paying my bills. Like, that's, it's so many words, right? And again, I'm not the Jonathan now that I was back then. The Jonathan now would have said so much more. But at that time, I'm just going, this does not feel good. Like, this feels really scary. And I said, so why do I need to sign this? And I just keep asking them that. They're like, well, and they're giving me all of these explanations as to why I need to sign it. And I said, are you trying to disfellowship me? I said, because you really truly have nothing on me. And mind you, when I did get to Cal State, I had a time, right?
I was thoughting and bopping.
I wouldn't even say thoughtin'. I think it was a lot of just let me be real. Yes, I was thoughtin'. But no, I think I really do think it was just I think that there were people at Cal State who were really excited to see someone who was so surely queer about themselves there. And there were a lot of other queer people on campus who were saying, we don't see enough of people who see, and again, I'm playing this up. I'm playing like I'm secure, but I'm really not. But I think people saw me and saw my security and was excited to see someone like me on campus, right? So all that to be said, they're still trying to get me to say yes to that all this stuff happened. And I'm saying, I'm not signing nothing. And they said, okay, well, you know, we can't guarantee, basically in so many words, they said, well, we can't guarantee you that you're not going to be disfellowshipped. And I said, well, you need to do what you need to do. And I got up from that room I left that Kingdom Hall and I've never been back to it ever since then. And it's something that I think I don't spend a lot of time thinking about. But there are moments where I'll see a Kingdom Hall and I'm like, oh, like I remember like my last time in one. The fact that I've had family members pass away and I've had to go back to that Kingdom Hall. I have seen people from the congregation just in passing, because, you know, as big as San Bernardino County is, it's still a very small place. And so, you know, you'll see people just, you know, at the store, or you'll see people in passing. Fortunately enough, these days when people see me, it's always like, oh my gosh, like, because again, you know, I usually am hopping out of Alexis and I
better. Right?
So I'm stunting a little bit. And so it just, it's a very different, oh my God, when people see me now. Uh-huh. But it is one of those things of like, when people even find me on social media, it's, you know, it's so good. A lot of them are saying, it's so good to see that you're doing so good, because one of the brothers, I will say this, when I told him I was going to college, he told me to my face that everything I was going to do was going to fail. He was like, because you're not doing it in Jehovah's honor. That's what he told me.
Well, you reverse that.
I know that's
okay. Reverse.
Draw four. But it is one of those things, right? Where you know, you just you a lot of that journey in me and my story is related to this religion and tied to this religion. That, like you said, when you asked the word trauma, there, there were fun moments and there were joyful moments, right, that I have, but those were so far few in between. It's actually really scary and really sad when you, when I sit and really think about it, you know? So,
you know, we're having this and really talking about the Black aspects, and we get a little extra day this month in Black History Month. Come on, leap year. What was it like being a Black queer baby in this time? As you were saying, they knew you were trying to navigate, like the glitter glistened. So they knew who you were, but like, what was it like? Do you feel like you were singled out? Do you feel like, I don't know, like you had more questions, you had less questions?
Yeah. You know, I think for me, a big part of all of this was, you know, when you think about like how it, so I will say this. Okay, I'm gonna start here. I will say that a big part of who I am in terms of like how well, because I get told this all the time, like in terms of like teaching, in terms of like communicating, in terms of like being that person that's not afraid to like speak up for myself or to like, you know, talk about issues per se and all that. A lot of that, like, I do have to credit the JW org for that, because a big part of, you know, what they teach the men, or at least at the time what they taught the men in the org, was how to be great communicators, right? Because a big part of your day, a big part. So again, and I was also at, before I left the org, I was a, what they call a full-time, oh gosh, what did they call them at the time? It was full-time. I wasn't a ministerial servant. I was basically someone who did 40 hours a week in door to door. Like I was on, like I was on the ground. Not, yeah, girl, I was still working part-time. I was still going to school, and I was still putting in 40 hours a week going door to door, telling people about quote unquote Jehovah's message. Right. And so I spent most of my days talking. Like that is literally what I became a man. And then I was still giving talks, right? So I don't know if you know what a talk is, but when you give a talk, basically on Tuesdays, you're basically given a topic out of the Bible, and you create this whole entire speech based off of this topic that these brothers hand you. And you are literally talking to like this massive audience of people.
So for like presenting.
Yeah, you like, you literally are doing exactly what pastors do, and I'm like 16, and
that's wild.
Isn't it wild like you are wild. Literally shepherding the congregation, because they're trying to get you to become one of the elders of it. Like your end goal as a young man, especially a young Black man in the JW org, is to become an elder of a congregation. Like when my grandfather became an elder, you would have thought he won the lottery, because the way people moved mountains for Paul Tolles when he became an elder. Yes.
Okay.
Like it's not something to sleep on. And so I was being shepherded in the same way. And so that's when you talk about little baby me, that's the good thing about it. I would say in terms of the thing, I just felt so isolated. I just felt very isolated. Even though I had friends, I never felt like, and it's something I still struggle with to this day. And I've mentioned it in so many facets, and I want to make sure that this doesn't come across as me saying like, I don't appreciate the people I have in my life. I do, but I think for me, there is still this thing, and it's something I'm currently working through. And that's why I went back to therapy. When you grow up in a religion and you're so self-aware of who you are and you're so scared of who you are, and you're fearful, like on so many different levels. And it's really hard to explain what different levels of fear I had. I had the fear of being coming out to my mom and my mom being disappointed, but I also had the fear of the religion finding out and the people in the organization being disappointed. And then also had the fear of my grandfather, who was an elder, who everyone loved and respected, them turning around and saying, oh, your grandson is queer and he's been disfellowshipped. Like there were just so many layers to the fear that I carried. And so I say that to say, like, going back to the conversation around friendship, I don't ever feel like people are really close to me, even when people are doing things for me to show me that they love and are close to me. I still feel very alone. And I think, you know, even up to this point at 38, you would think, you know, with the followers and the career I've created and my husband and the circle of friends I have and the people I hang out with, everyone thinks, oh, John, you're so loved and you're so surrounded and you're so, but there are moments where I still feel so alone. And it's because of the damage that the religion did in terms of isolating me as a child.
That's such a real thing that people don't talk about, right? Like like within trauma, we do hold it with us, and it shows up in so many different ways that people are always like, well, you've been left the religion. Look at all these things, right? Like Little Mermaid, look at all these things. Aren't they? No, they're not all neat, because you still have everything from before. Like you don't forget that.
Yeah. Like,
the ways that you grew up when you were supposed to have connection, they didn't exist in the same manner.
And my therapist is so good in these conversations with me, because, you know, while the two of them may not correlate, there's still this notion, and we're working through it. She goes, you know, your 16-year-old self had to basically sit with the notion of you only had one person going to bat for you, which was your mother, right? Mm-hmm. And so now at 38, I've taken in all of those years of feeling like the only person I have is me and I have to protect me. Right. And so I think that's where some of that isolation comes from. And this is what I think, you know, this conversation, when we really look at, you know, obviously we can zone in and say, woo, being a Jehovah's Witness is spooky, it's scary. Okay. But when you zoom out, there is this piece of how damaging it is to so many people who've been, like, I've talked to so many other people. I'm in groups on Facebook. I've talked to so many other people who were a part of the org. And when you talk to them and we talk about how sad we become sometimes, or how certain times we feel so triggered about certain things and we don't know where it comes from, there's just so much damage. There's so many of the people in the org. And that's the thing, I think. I think there are a lot of people who are damaged that would rather stay in the org and not have to deal with the damage that has been done versus the people who leave the org and say, I'm going to do the work I need to do to heal from a lot of the terrible things I've heard or have been told, or even terrible things I've seen. I mean, you know,
that's just hard.
Just talking about trauma, I don't know if you know, but Jehovah Witnesses are extremely calculated about how they hide sexual assault in the org. They're extremely calculated about the ways that they that they assault young women, a lot of the elders in a lot of different halls. And this is nothing I'm just saying to say. This stuff is stuff that is out in the news. They have had whole exposés on women who have gone to try to hold the elders and the ministerial servants and the people over at Bethel, you know, the women who were sent to Bethel and were raped at Bethel. Like, there are all of these things. So there's just so much, like, I guess the larger thing I can say, there's so much trauma around this religion that is cloaked with this notion of, we're extremely happy, shiny people, and this is the best religion, and this is the only religion that you should be giving your heart to because it's the right religion, right? But when you start digging and you start moving things and you start really starting to understand what the religion is, it's just like any other cult that's out there. There's a lot of grief behind it.
If you could, what would you say to younger you?
I think, so I'm trying, there's so many things I want to say to my younger self. I think the first thing I would probably say is run, fast, like or I would have even told myself not to get baptized. I would have told myself, don't do it, because you didn't want to do it in the first place.
Listen to that gut.
And you didn't want to do it, and you did it. And not that you regret it, but I think for me, it was just, there was so much pressure when I was 14 to get baptized. And I didn't want to. And that's the other thing in the religion. Like, usually in most religions, from what I know, because again, I don't really know what other churches and people do. In other religions, getting baptized just kind of means, oh, okay, I got baptized. It is what it is. I'm just, you know, I'm Christian. I'm a born again Christian. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there are things you can and cannot do in the Jehovah's Witness organization when you are baptized and when you're not baptized. And so the pressure for men specifically to get baptized is there because there are all of these things that they set you up for that make, like, for instance, going to Bethel. You can't go to Bethel if you're not baptized. So, like, there's that pressure, right? If you're 14 and you're being told by these men that your goal and your dream should be to get to Bethel because it's this big thing, obviously you're going to feel the pressure to get baptized, right? And so that was a big part of the thing I would have told 14-year-old me, like, girl, you don't want to do this. Like, why are you going to do that? You ain't trying to go to Bethel, girl. Like, don't do that. So I would have literally told myself that, but I think I would have told myself sooner. You know, at 18, instead of staying just at Cal State, I probably would have went further. And that was the other thing. Well, Cal State is okay because it's still here. We can still keep an eye on you, right? Yeah, and that's what it was.
Close enough still.
Yeah. It was you know, I would have gone to Mount, like, that was my dream school. My dream school still to this day was Hawaii at Manoa. Like, I wanted to go to Oahu so bad for college. And I didn't because I was so fearful that being in Hawaii would quote unquote take me away from Jehovah, that I sacrificed that, right? And so there were just a lot of things that I would tell myself. I think I would tell myself outside of religion is, you know, I would have told myself very on that you are going to have the life that you've always wanted. And it's not going to come the way it's not going to come the way that you think it's going to come. Right. Yeah. You know, I I've talked very openly about this, right. I was sneak watching Will and Grace a lot when I was a teenager. And so I thought I was going to be Will Truman. I thought I was going to have a best friend named Jack or a best friend named Karen, or, you know, a Grace Adler. And I thought I was just going to be living it up in Los Angeles or New York. I really thought that's what my life was going to be. And my life looks absolutely nothing like that now.
Because you go to WeHo.
I mean, no, I don't. I pop in LA, but I'm not an LA girl, and I don't think I'm gonna ever be an LA girl. When I say LA girl, what I mean by that is there's just a certain faction of people who are truly LA people, and I don't think that's ever gonna be who I am. But I do have friends in LA, and I do have a lot of, you know, I know where Jessica Garcia is going to be on the show in a couple of, you know, weeks. And, I definitely am very close to her. I have a lot of really cool friends that run in your circle that I'm also really good friends with. But I say all of that to say, like, I would tell myself to not be dead set on believing that my life is going to look a certain way and being okay with the different interstates, the different twisted turns that my life were going to take, because all of those twists and turns were going to make my life the life that I wanted. So
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think if we were those people, we would have never known each other and we wouldn't have known ourselves, honestly. Yeah.
Nope.
Like the ways that you've gotten to learn who you are. You mentioned that it wasn't all bad. Like you were like, there were some times, like, what were the highs and the lows for you?
Yeah, I think the highs was, I mean, one of the biggest highs was, and I still am so proud of that person, right? I'm no longer the 18, 19, 20 year old Jonathan who, you know, was so, and again, I still deal with what do people think about me? You know, a big part of the reason why I live in therapy, and I say live in therapy because I do it every 2 weeks. The reason why I live in therapy is because I'm constantly a people pleaser. I'm a person who deals with perfectionism. I know all of that stems from the religion. I know a lot of the issues that I have with myself stem from this notion of being in a religion where I felt like everything I was doing and everything I didn't do was clocked. But what I will say is that I'm still super proud of that 18-year-old going on 19-year-old me who went into that room and said, I'm not signing that. I know something's wrong here and I don't feel comfortable being here, so I'm not coming back. I often too will say the highs of having other Jehovah Witnesses see me, learn my story, and opt to follow me or to build a relationship with me because they say, oh, there is a Jehovah Witness out there or an XJW out there who is actually doing really well in life. And I want to say that, like, I want to say shout out to my friend Risha Howard. That's how we became friends. Like, she saw one of my tweets and she was like, oh my God, I have been basically dying to find another witness who I could talk to openly and not feel like I was in some way, shape or form, like going against my family or my friends by talking about my, and so every once in a while, me and Risha will have conversations about our experiences, what triggers us, what makes us laugh, what makes us sad. You know, but all of that to be said, I think that's one of the highs. The highs is really trusting myself enough to know that there was a better life out there. I think the low that I often sit with is just the disconnect I have with my family. I genuinely believe that the religion played a big part of that. Even before I left the religion, my family was so distant from one another. And, you know, my mom is still a witness. My mom's a devout witness, but she talks to me.
Is she?
Yeah, okay. She still is.
I didn't know she was.
Mm-hmm. She still is. But my mom, my mom is one of those witnesses that says, I do what I want to do and ain't nobody going to tell me, you know,
she,
how.
I know she right.
My mom is a witness the way she wants to be a witness. And so we just leave it alone. But I say all of that to say, I think one of the lows really is, you know, I talk to my cousin a lot and he tells me, you know, I wish that we weren't. So, because again, I had an aunt who was most of my younger years, she was disfellowshipped. And only recently did we openly, like, as cousins, just kind of say, yeah, she was disfellowshipped, but whatever. Like, we need to talk to auntie. You know, we need to make sure she's doing all right. And so it's just, it sucks because so much of these beliefs have separated us and has kept us from knowing each other, has kept us from loving each other the way that we want. And I'm committed. You know, I try to talk to my brother as much as possible. I try to talk to my mom as much as possible. I told them, I said, I never want to get to a place where I let a religion break me and my family up in that way.
You kind of talked about, excuse me, in the beginning, religion and spirituality. Do you consider yourself to be a spiritual person today?
Yeah, you know, yes and no. Okay. I'm not going to outrightly say I don't believe in God. I will say I don't believe in the faction of God that has been created by imperfect people. That's okay. The way I look at it. There are so many different things that people believe to be true about, quote unquote, the big man in the sky. And I'm going, you don't even know what the gender is. Like, you don't know who that person is up there. You know, I don't know them either. So how am I going to put gender on somebody I don't know? It's weird, but it's just one of those things. You know, I always like to say, I And I don't know if it's, you know, because I believe in so many different things. You know, I believe that there is a force that has created us as long along with the universe and the and whether it be a 10-foot alien or whether it be a 2-foot alien, all the things in the universe. I know something. It came from somewhere. That's where I start. Yeah. Something or someone made that happen. Right. So big ups to them for that. Obviously, I got put here too. So thank you. I appreciate it. However, when I start talking about my own spirituality, my own spirituality pulls in from this notion of I have never, ever been in a situation where I've had to. How do I say this? I'm a believer that my steps are ordered. I believe that I was put on this earth for a specific reason. And I believe that more than ever now. And I believe that the universe, God, you know, Jesus Christ, like, I don't know who it is, but I believe that something put me on this earth to say, you are going to do things that you genuinely never thought you'd be able to do. And you are going to inspire people in ways that you never thought you'd be able to inspire them. That is what I believe my calling to be. But I also believe that there are certain people and there are certain energies that I have lost that also work as my spiritual guides and my spiritual people. And I say this because I often think about it. There are things that happened for me that I told my friend Carla that I go, that happened because I know Carla had something to do with it. She's no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. I believe that she had something to do with my podcast because she would always say, you have something to say and the world needs to hear it. And I know it's going to happen. Like that was her thing. She would tell me while she was here. And I get so choked up talking about Carla because I miss her so much. And I know, like, I have a, there's a, if you ever come into my office, you've been into my apartment. If you come into my office, there is a, basically it's a, I don't know what to call it. It's not a poster, but it's also not a picture, but there's something that she gave me and it says, do not follow the path. Do not follow where the path may lead. Go instead where the path, leaves a trail. And she gave that to me and I put it on my wall. And so there's this thing of me like knowing that she's always with me. Same with my friend Matt, who I'm dedicating my book to. Same thing to my best friend Loretta, who I lost when I was in high school. You know, I feel like those energies are the ones who have guided me. And so, yeah. I don't know how I guess because you asked me about spirituality. I just want to go back to it too. I think one of the other sad things that I forgot that was on my mind. I didn't get to say goodbye to my grandfather before he passed because he wouldn't talk to me.
Because of Jehovah.
Mm-hmm. And so when he died, we weren't on speaking terms. And there were a lot of things I wanted to say to him that I didn't get to, both good and bad. But that was also something that I went back to and I was like, yeah, that kind of sucked. But all that to be said, am I a spiritual person? Very much so. I believe in, like, you know me, I got crystals everywhere. You know, I don't say prayers all the time, but I'm definitely a believer that the energy is watching me and it's moving with me and it's continuing to keep me, keeps me going, honey. Especially on days like today where I don't feel like going, honey. So.
Which is the question I was going to ask next, because it's me. How do you take care of yourself? Like, you have navigated many things and, you know, it takes a lot of work to undo the things that have happened to us. People always say, you should just go to therapy. Girl, therapy is a journey. And so as you are unraveling and processing and having some of those questions answered and or finding new questions, how do you take care of yourself?
How do I say? Well, this, you know, I will say 2023. So I was real big on in the wave of like, ooh, self-care. I got to take care of me. I got a little bit of change. I'm going to go down to the, I'm going to go get a massage. I'm going to go down to the spa. And it's a real thing. You know, I want to say, and I want to make sure that I make it very clear. I am very thankful and grateful for the multi streams of income I have. I work very hard. And my bank accounts show that. I'm very thankful to have money that I can move around, I can play with. I can spend money knowing money is going to come back in. But I used to believe that money was going to make my stress level and my stressors. I even thought buying things was going to make my stress level less. And I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe that. Yeah. I think how I'm taking care of myself is by only doing things that I feel like I genuinely in my gut, like I love and I enjoy, if that makes sense. Like working for Rainbow Pride Youth Alliance and putting together this conference that I'm putting together in February, that makes me feel like I'm taking care of myself because I'm giving back to a community of queer and Black people that oftentimes are overlooked in our community here in the Inland Empire, right? That makes me feel good. Podcasting each week when I have people reach out and they say, oh, you touched on this topic of something that I've been dealing with and I was scared to acknowledge it, but it made me feel whole. That makes me feel like I'm taking care of myself by giving a part of myself away. When I can go to sleep on my purple pillow, changing up my apartment a little bit here and there, and you know, and going to therapy and having real conversations with not only the people I love, but the real conversations with myself. I will say this, a lot of stuff is about to change for me in 2024. There are a lot of people that are going to find pink slips that didn't think they were going to get pink slips.
Sometimes you got to release.
Just these are all of the things that I know I have to do to take care of me, right? Mm-hmm. The friendships that I've had to abruptly cut off and say, hey, I don't think that you're good for me anymore, or accepting that other people didn't want me in their life either. Like, that's how I'm taking care of me. I'm taking care of me by, like, what I said at the top of this, right? Like, I'm doing the best that I can to figure out how do I center myself and how do I do things that specifically are going to inherently make me the best me that I can be in a world that is constantly trying to tear me down and break me apart, you know, so.
Every day. Okay, well, this just one thing before I get to the last question, I think I would be, I feel like if I didn't touch on this, I would be doing a disservice to myself and the listeners. Social media. Mm-hmm. We're going to make a little left here.
That's fine.
As someone who is actively on there as a very outwardly Black, queer, non-binary human, what do you ever see any correlation to the ways that you navigated religion?
You know, yes, that is actually a really good question. And it's something I actually never have really engaged. But yeah, when you really want to talk about it, you know, the fear of saying what you need to say, or the fear of being your authentic self on social media. I think that that's the correlation, right? So in the religion, it was people only liked me when I performed way I wanted them to perform. When I was in the suit and I was in the tie, you know what? I'm going to get to the point, but also I want to say something that made me feel really good this week. So I cleaned out my closet and I had a suit in my closet and I put the suit in the donation bag and I no longer own any suits. And it is suits and ties. Even though suits and ties are very much business attire, they're still a very strong tie to Jehovah's Witnesses with suits and ties for me.
Yes.
I don't own any suit and ties anymore. And
release.
It is the most freeing thing. So I just wanted to say that's a big part of it. But when you talk about performance, right? Yes, the religion was very much when you put on a suit and tie and you go door to door and you come to the meetings and you've read the Bible and you've read the books that we've given you to read about the Bible and you raise your hands and you're given the correct answers or you're saying what needs to be said and you're given the talks and you're walking up and down with the mics, baby, they work you. Like, I want to make sure I make that very clear that they work the hell out of you when you are a young Jehovah's Witness. It's free labor. Why not? But I say all of that to say it's the same way with social media, right? I've had so many people on social tell me, baby, you might be missing an opportunity because you're talking about whiteness, or you're talking too loudly about, you know, anti-blackness, mm-hmm. or you're talking too loudly about the need to free Palestine, or you're talking too loudly about fat politics, or you're talking too loudly about the white execs who are doing all of these things. And I have to sit with that and I have to say, no, y'all only want to work with me and only want to vibe or follow me when I say the things that make you, when you don't have to acknowledge the ways that you play into the oppression of people who look and live like me. Yeah. And so I think that that's something that I'm constantly, like I said, I don't think about it a lot, but I am going to be thinking about it a lot more, because a lot of it, what it all boils down to is respectability politics. It all mm-hmm. boils down to the idea that people often only like and love you when you show up the way that they want you to show up. And I'm not talking about people who are, you know, outwardly abusive and mean and nasty. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying when I talk about authentically yourself, you know, if you have family members that you only talk to, or that you don't talk to because they are a little too feminine, or they're a little too, you know, they're a little too pro queer, or they're a little too pro, you know, the freedom of Black people, right? Or they want to challenge you on the ways that you show up in your privilege. That's the kind of stuff that I'm talking about. And so, yeah, I think, you know, having a social media platform, having people know you for things. Sometimes I do think, you know, maybe I'm not as far in my career because of the ways that I talk about things and the ways that I look at the way I keep holding folks accountable. But then there's also a part of me that says, would I really be happy if I was getting to those places by not being my authentic self?
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I took that left. I don't know where I was going with it, but look where we landed. I loved it. Yeah. I love that adventure for us.
Yeah.
So my last question is truly because I'm nosy. What is the wildest thing that someone has texted or DM'd you in the past 2 weeks? And wild can vary.
You know, yes, I'm going to say this because actually I think it's not, so it's not related to me, but when we were talking about it, I was like, I got to bring it up. So most people know I'm married, so I don't ever really get a lot of people jumping into my DMs.
Somebody dropping off dick in your DM?
No, I've never had that happen. Yeah. No, okay, I'm just saying a lot of people know I'm married, so I don't ever really get the whole, yeah, you know, random penis or the random people tend to be very respectful of me. And I've had people try. I've had people be like, yo, I'm like, I'm married, I'm happy, get out of here. What I will say, though, that was really funny was when you talk about DM. So a friend had me on her close uh-huh. friends list. And she is one of the girls who is on a lot of the dating apps. I think that might have been Tinder. And so what was wild to me was somebody on her close friend, she had posted, she was like, this is why I deleted this app. But it had a man, I think you might have seen this, when he put in, he was like a couple of miles away from her. And he was like, oh, girl, you look like you can suck a mean dick. And she said, her response to it, which to me had me dying, she said, ha, that's funny that you say that because so do you. I said, yes, bitch, get them together. Like, that to me was what, like, how do you DM somebody on Hinge or on Tinder? You look like you're the wildest mean dick. And it just, to me, I was screaming because she's like, ha, funny you would say that because so do you. Baby, when I tell you that sent me to the moon. I said that for me is wild. But yeah, that's the wildest.
You know what? You are so lucky to have never had to really get in them swiping and swiping, especially nowadays. There is no respect. They just be like, match, show me your titties. What? Or,
and I know it. I know
the wildest. It, but, yeah. What does your butthole look like?
Wow. People have no couth. No couth. Yeah. None of it.
Mm. This has been so fun for me as anytime we're together.
Yeah.
Where can people find you? Where can they be in your business? How can they keep up with you?
Well, currently you can find me in a purple store asking for them to sponsor me and give me one of them mattresses to go with my pillow.
I need one too.
baby, it changed the game. It changed the game. I'm literally every day talking. I'm trying to get my partner to say yes to me buying a mattress from them, but that's neither here nor there. But other than that, you can find me on social media by using the handle at Dr. John Paul. You can also visit me at www.drjohnpaul.com. You can also listen to me and Jiminika. You have been a guest on my show. Last year, you were a guest on our show. You can find me over on the iHeart Network Black Fat Femme Pod.
You better be booked.
Yeah.
All right, y'all. Until next time.